Chapter 41. Hesperus had a message for me when I emerged from abeyance. I had intended to come out when Silver Wings was approaching the Stardam, just before I expected the opener to activate. As it was, I came back to the living during a major space battle, almost a micro-war, between the cordon around the Stardam and the ship they were trying to stop. To call it a battle implies a certain even-handedness to the affair, but in fact it was a ruthlessly one-sided bloodbath. Silverwings brushed aside the local civilization's efforts as if it was almost beneath her dignity to acknowledge them at all. But they did not give up, even when they had thrown dozens of ships against that hopelessly invulnerable target. The humans and machines kept coming. I watched with horrified, dumbstruck fascination. "I failed," Hesperus told me after I had heard Perslane's final message to me, the one she had recorded before entering abeyance. He was signaling me from an hour ahead, calm despite the horrific destruction that was taking place all around him. "I told Perslane that we had one chance of stopping this ship by destroying the White Ark. I believed it was in my power to do so, but I was mistaken. Unfortunately, I could not know for sure until I sent the final command. There was no way to gauge its effectiveness until that moment." He told me everything that had happened. How he and Perslane had come to a mutual decision to destroy the ship, thereby preventing the massacre of the cordon and the subsequent opening of the Stardam. He told me how he had persuaded Perslane to take refuge in a stasis casket, so that she might have some slim but measurable chance of surviving the destruction of the Ark, the opener, and the larger ship in which both were contained. Satisfied that I had done all I could, that Perslane was as safe as I could make her, I issued the command. A moment later, when I found myself still conscious, I knew that it had been unsuccessful. Perslane had been cleverer than both of us, Campion. Cleverer than me. Cleverer even than her future self. She had already taken measures to protect the opener against sabotage, so I suppose it was only natural that she would have considered this possibility as well. The command was intercepted and neutralized by fail-safe screens I had not detected until that moment. But it is much worse than that. The opener has triggered. I sensed the graviton pulse racing ahead of Silverwings. I do not know whether my command precipitated the activation of the opener, or whether it was simply time for it to happen, but we have failed. Hesperus paused long enough for me to think his message had ended. Then he said, "We are slowing. You will have detected that already. But I may as well confirm it in case you doubt your instruments. This will make it simple for you to catch up with us, but since the opener has already activated, nothing would now be gained from destroying Silverwings. You may, of course, choose to regard this message as unreliable. I would not blame you if you did, but you may also wish to consider the implications of our deceleration. Left on its present course, and we have not begun to deviate from it, Silverwings will run into the Stardam only a few hours after the arrival of the opener transmission. At our previous velocity, the dam would not have opened sufficiently to allow a ship to slip between two of the ringworlds, but we are slowing, and that changes everything. The margin will still be narrow, but I believe that the additional time before our arrival will allow Silverwings to enter the dam. This velocity correction was locked in 30 centuries of ship time ago, Campion. I believe it was always the robot's intention to pass through the Stardam and to encounter whatever lies at its heart. The purpose of their mission was to release the first machines, but they must also have been desirous of making contact with those machines in Andromeda. The robots were intending to make a wormhole traversal, and I do not believe anything can now stop that from happening. He was silent again, giving me time to reflect on the scraps of intelligence we had learned from Gallingale before we packed him off to Neume and the tender mercies of Miserion. The door, the aperture, the mouth, the macroscopic wormhole connection between our galaxy and Andromeda. I finally realized why Hesperus was telling me this. The Stardam may not stay in its open configuration forever. I cannot promise you that Silverwings will survive the transition. This is not a journey any human ship has ever completed, but if you do not follow, you may never get another chance. It is a long way to Andromeda by the other route. I transmitted my reply. If the cordon lets me through, I'm going to keep on following. The line's instructions to the local civilizations had been precise about the nature of the objective, and although the ships and defense stations of their cordon had been devastated, no one tried to take their revenge out on Dalliance. They understood that I had been chasing Silverwings for 62,000 years. They understood that I meant them no harm. Silverwings had dropped down to 80% of the speed of light. I followed suit after allowing myself to fall within 5 minutes of the other ship. The cordon made a last effort to stop Silverwings, even though the opener had already activated. Their weapons barely grazed her, even at her reduced speed. Ahead, the dark, nested machinery of the Star Dam began to respond to the signal. The ringworlds, held in place by pushers, began to tilt away from their existing inclinations. It was a deathly slow adjustment, but the monitoring devices around the Star Dam confirmed that the change was real and ongoing. No alarm was raised, for the monitoring devices knew only that an authenticated Gentian opener had sent that command. A widening lens-shaped aperture was appearing along the circumference of the Star Dam, as if a dark marble was slowly opening its single lazy eye. Over the course of hours, Silverwings continued her deceleration, falling to 50% of light, then to a third. She was still aimed precisely at the opening eye. If there was one scant piece of consolation to be drawn, it was in the absence of hellish light pouring through that gap. No supernova had been contained by this Star Dam. The local civilizations were at least safe from that particular hazard. There was every likelihood that Gallingale had been telling the truth. I watched Silverwings of Morning fall through the gap, into the black clockwork of the Star Dam. She held her course for several light seconds, then began to veer hard, passing out of my line of sight. A few minutes later a signal came through, staggered as it arrived from multiple reflection points. Dalliance sorted through the jumbled puzzle and dragged out a coherent message. "This is Hesperus. I trust you can still receive me, Campion. We have begun to execute a series of increasingly violent course adjustments so that we may pass through the gaps between the interior ringworlds. These adjustments are of such severity that the inertial compensation is no longer working properly. Unshielded forces have been in excess of 500 gravities and are still rising. Perslane is safe in stasis, but she would not have survived had she still been in real time. I urge you to take similar precautions. Silverwings is still out of my direct control, but I can transmit a record of our trajectory to Dalliance, so that you may maintain your pursuit. With foreknowledge of the interior conditions, you may be able to ease the stresses on your ship." "Thank you," I said. "I'll go into stasis. Good luck, Hesperus. I hope you make it."
"I'll see you on the other side, Campion. We'll have much to discuss, I think."
"I expect we will," I said, wondering why he suddenly sounded so much more human. Presently, Dalliance informed me that it had a lock on Silverwing's trajectory. She was zigzagging deeper and deeper into the Star Dam, squeezing between gaps that were in some cases only a few thousand kilometers wide. Hesperus had been right to warn me into abeyance. It would be difficult enough for Dalliance to follow, let alone to do so in a way that would protect her fragile human cargo. There was just time to transmit a message to the line, aimed in the rough direction of Neume, telling them of my plans. I also fired a copy towards the nearest node of the private network, deciding that it no longer mattered whether or not the network had been compromised. I did not even know for certain that there were any other Gentians alive. We had travelled so fast that only a few centuries' worth of information had managed to catch up with us from Neume. Satisfied that I had done all I could, I left Dalliance to follow Perslane's trail and whisk to the Abeyance Chamber. I dialed the casket to 1,000,000, set the expiration clock to 100 hours of ship time, a wild guess, since I had no idea how long it would take to reach the heart of the Star Dam or complete the subsequent wormhole transition, and allowed the field to enfold me. 4 seconds of consciousness later, I was back in real time. I emerged from the casket. The room was exactly as I had left it. Gravity was normal, the ride smooth. Deep inside the ship as I was, there was no visible evidence of damage or trauma to its systems. For a moment I wondered if Hesperus had tricked me by guiding Dalliance onto a trajectory that caused it to miss the Star Dam completely, placing a higher premium on my survival than on keeping his word. I quickly dismissed the thought. He knew that I would sooner die than not follow Perslane all the way in. According to the clock in the head portion of the casket, 10 days really had passed. I whisked back up to the bridge, feeling as if I had only just been there. When I arrived, I found all superficial indications normal, as if Dalliance was just floating in space, becalmed in flat vacuum. But the displayer was very reluctant to show me anything. It would not relay an external view, claiming that it was having trouble achieving a consistent description of our surroundings. Nor would it hazard a guess as to Dalliance's present position. Its last reliable astrogation fix had been just before we entered the Stardam, but according to the ship's memory of its own motions, it should have passed through the Stardam nearly 100 hours ago. Yet it was still unable to get a reading from any navigation pulsars or beacons, or locate a pattern of stars that it recognized. In fact, it could not locate any stars at all. So we were somewhere else, not necessarily in the Milky Way anymore. Maybe we were inside the dark envelope of the Andromeda absence, floating in a starless void that had once been a galaxy. I settled into my control seat and tugged down the floating console, punching commands to force the displayer to give me something, even if it was against its better judgment. Dalliance was so protective of me that it would rather withhold data than show me something it regarded as highly suspect, possibly distorted by the machine equivalent of hallucinatory delirium. But in the end I prevailed. It was a mistake. I cannot adequately describe what I saw. I was aware that I was seeing only Dalliance's attempt to translate its perceptions into a form that might be comprehensible to me, an echo of an echo, but it was still too much, too strange, too alien. Vast and luminous structures were rushing past in too many directions for my mind to process, approaching and receding at the same time, shifting from one shape to another in a constant fluid progression that made me think less of machinery, of some natural phenomenon, than of a protean creature inverting itself, turning itself inside out over and over again. I had an impression of appalling speed and appalling motionlessness, as if Dalliance was being swept along at the mercy of a storm, and at the same time creating that storm around itself, sitting in perfect tranquility in the calm eye of its own making. Unless what I was seeing represented conditions inside the absence, then I had to accept that we were still riding the wormhole. The Priors made this, I thought. We had assumed that their science was superior to ours when we contemplated their ringworlds and the ancient sphinx-like machines floating around the Milky Way's central black hole. In truth, we had understood nothing of their true capabilities. Faced with such a gulf of comprehension, my mind wanted to curl up inside my skull and hope that the universe would go away. In 6 million years, we had not even scratched the surface of the possible. We had barely recognized that there was a surface to scratch. I thought of returning to Abeyance, but since I still had no idea how much longer would be required, I chose to administer Synchromesh. I dialed myself up to 10, maintaining enough of a grip on external time to be able to respond to outside events. After 3 hours of consciousness, 30 hours of ship time, I received a message from what Dalliance tentatively identified as Ahead. It was from Hesperus. His signal dopplered in and out, as if Silverwings was experiencing absurd changes in velocity, one instant moving away from me at half the speed of light, the next surging closer at a quarter. I could only assume that the space-time between our two ships was highly elastic. "I hope you can still hear me, Campion. I have a hailing fix on your ship, which suggests you have retained at least some basic functionality. The time lag between us is shifting unpredictably. It may be that we will move out of signaling range at any moment. I am afraid Silverwing suffered damage during the latter stages of the passage through the Stardam and the insertion into the wormhole. I am doing what I can to stabilize the ship and consolidate her basic functions, but I am fighting against the system blockades cascade installed. I cannot say how much longer it will be before we emerge back into conventional space, but I believe the exit transition will be no less violent than the entrance transition. You may fare better, for your ship is smaller and perhaps more agile. I will do all in my power to protect Purslane, but I cannot promise that I will succeed." "I'm in one piece," I said. "Dalliance is struggling to orientate herself, but otherwise she's in good shape." His response took 40 minutes to arrive. "That is welcome news, Campion. I would, nonetheless, recommend that you return to Abeyance at the earliest opportunity.
Set your apparatus in such a way that I may bring you out, when I have deemed that our ships are safe.
Thanks, Hesperus, but I'm fine as I am.
This time his answer arrived within 90 seconds. It must be your decision, Campion. Regardless, the instant I detect the transition back to normal space, I will send warning of it. You may still have time to protect yourself before Dalliance runs into difficulties.
Have you seen anything coming the other way?
The concept of other way is a problematic one, given the confused state of our surroundings.
This time I had to wait 11 minutes for his reply, and his message was redshifted almost to the point of incomprehensibility.
But if I take your meaning correctly, I have detected no other physical objects occupying the wormhole. The only two ships appear to be ours. You are doubtless wondering about the first machines.
It crossed my mind that if there are invasion fleets waiting to escape back into our galaxy, we aren't seeing much sign of them. 5 seconds later he said,
"You were gone a very long time, then, Campion. I began to worry about you. It is a great relief to find that you are still alive. Concerning your observation, you have a point. It may still be too soon to form ready judgments, but the absence of any traffic, let alone indirect evidence of the first machines, it is indeed puzzling.
I wonder what Cadence and Cascade would be saying now if they were still around."
"I imagine they would be vexed," Hesperus said 2.5 hours later.
"We know the first machines existed. That's not in dispute, is it?" 11 minutes.
"I met them, Campion. It was a long time ago, but I don't think my memory is playing tricks with me."
"I'm not sure how you can have met them, but I know there's a lot you and Perslane haven't been able to tell me. I'm burning with questions, but the most important one is, where are they?"
15 seconds. "Perhaps when we emerge, we will have a better idea."
"What do you think we'll find when we reach Andromeda? Are we even going to be able to exist inside the absence?"
19 hours, 22 minutes. "Cadence and Cascade must have expected to continue to exist, or they would not have set silver wings on this course."
After a moment he added,
"Of course, they were robots. That may have factored into their thinking."
I smiled at this far from comforting answer. "What do you think they were hoping to achieve?"
6 hours. "To meet the first machines, to be welcomed as pilgrims unto God. I saw into Cadence's mind, Campion. That is how it felt to her, as if this was a pilgrimage with a sacred destination." Then Hesperus added, "I am detecting something, a change in the local conditions. Perhaps you feel it as well. I think we may be approaching the emergence point. You should hasten to abeyance, Campion. I cannot..."
Something cut him off. It was sudden and total. There was no longer even a carrier signal from Silverwings. "Hesperus?" Nothing returned. I waited a minute. 10 more. Then I whisked to the abeyance chamber, dialed in 100 hours at a stasis level of 1,000,000, and submitted myself to the mercy of the casket. A spine of stars arced across the sky, hazy with the light of 1,000,000,000 suns, none of which had ever been given human names. I thought back to the amplified sky over the Centaur's world, the taste of strong wine on my lips as Perslane and I sat by the bay at night, watching Dr. Menninx take his swim, waiting with nervous anticipation for Mr. Nebulae to deliver his verdict on my trove. I had seen the Milky Way then, daubed across the sky. I was seeing it again now, except that this was another Milky Way, another spiral arm, arcing across the sky of a different galaxy. It looked achingly familiar, but I was 2.5 million years from home. One grove of stars may look much like another, but I was not even in the same forest. I knew I had travelled, rather than simply being ejected back into the galaxy at some other point in space or time. Although the surroundings were familiar, the specifics were not. Dalliance listened for the tick of 1,000 pulsars and heard none that it recognized. There were pulsars in the galactic disk, but none of them were rotating at the right frequencies. Even allowing for 1,000,000 years of slowdown, even allowing for 10 million, none of the pulsars could be matched against the fixed clocks it had come to expect. The same could be said for the brightest stars in the sky, those that we would have shrouded with star dams back home. None of them fitted the maps. I was in terra incognita. Not quite. It was not as if Andromeda had gone unobserved during all the millions of years before the absence. There was data in the troves concerning Andromedan stellar populations, Andromedan pulsars, Andromedan globular clusters, even the positions and stellar types of individual stars. Given time, Dalliance's navigation system might have been able to sift through that jumble of ancient data, extrapolate it forwards, correlate it against its current observations, and come to some rough and ready estimate of our present position. Sooner or later I would have an idea where I was, even if it did not depend on any nearby galactic landmarks. I was still in the local group, after all. I told Dalliance to locate the Milky Way and any other local group galaxies it could find, and triangulate our present position. It did not have to be accurate to more than a few thousand lights in any direction. I would settle for knowing which spiral arm I was in. Dalliance attended to the task. While I was waiting for its answer, I set about looking for anything of interest nearby. Of Hesperus and Silver Wings I found no evidence at all. I did not know whether to take this as a good sign or not. It was better than finding wreckage, but only slightly. I tried omnidirectional hails, but even after 100 hours nothing came back. The sky was silent except for the mindless squawking and whistling of radio stars and quasars. The galaxy I knew was a thrum with human babble. This was a mausoleum. Dalliance was still cogitating. There was a planet behind me, falling away at a third of the speed of light. The planet had no sun. It had either been moved into interstellar space deliberately, or ejected from its solar system during some ancient gravitational encounter. The planet was an airless, cratered husk, illuminated by starlight alone. But there was something orbiting it, a smudge of spatial distortion, the open mouth of the wormhole that had carried me here. The prior machinery propping that shaft open was so unthinkably advanced that it was not even contained in the visible dimensions of macroscopic space. I told Dalliance to calculate an accurate reading of the planet's course so that we could find it again. Then I asked it why it was taking so long to triangulate on the local group. It told me it was having trouble finding the galaxy where I had been born, in the direction where it should have been, based on the assumed identities of the other galaxies in the group. There was only a black oval, peppered with a scattering of stars, lying just outside its boundary. It was a second absence. Dizzy with the implications of this discovery, my preconceptions unhinged, I told Dalliance to assume that the second absence was indeed the old galaxy, and to triangulate on that basis. This time it did not take long at all. I was in Andromeda. My position was defined to within a cubic volume 1,000 lights along each side. Now Dalliance could even make a stab at identifying some of the celestial landmarks surrounding us. 6,000 years in the direction of the galactic center was a stellar nursery known to the Trove, still birthing suns and worlds. 30,000 lights beyond that was a whipping star, a close cousin to our galaxy's own SS-433. I struggled to grasp how everything could look so familiar. In all directions I saw normal-looking stars, drifting in normal associations, following normal orbits. Beyond the stars, I could see globular clusters, satellite galaxies of Andromeda, and other more distant galaxies. I could see beyond the local group, into the sparse immensity of the local cluster. And beyond the local cluster, the deep structure of creation, galactic voids and galactic superclusters. Beyond the furthest superclusters, I heard the warble of high redshift quasars, and the kettle drum hiss of cosmic background radiation. Nothing was out of place. Nothing was abnormal. There was no sign of the absence, no black fog enveloping everything, no black curtain wrapped around the galaxy, shielding it from the rest of the universe. I knew then that every assumption we had made about the absence had been wrong. It was not what we imagined, not in the slightest. It appeared that we had been wrong about the first machines as well. They were nowhere to be found. But someone had reactivated the wormhole, I reminded myself. Shortly afterwards I picked up a Gentian signal. It was dismayingly faint, but because it was the only made thing in all that random hissing and squawking of cosmic noise, it was trivial to isolate. If its spatial direction was to be believed, it appeared to be coming from a solar system more than 3,000 lights from my present position. Before my hopes rose, I assured myself that it could not possibly be Purslane.
Unless she had emerged from a different wormhole throat, she could not possibly have travelled so far, so fast. But with nothing better to do, no other clues to follow, I told Dalliance to follow the signal anyway. Stasis compressed the 150 years of ship time of the voyage to a few minutes of consciousness, scarcely worth the bother of synchromesh. The signal grew in strength as I neared, unwavering except for a cyclical frequency shift caused by the orbit of a planet around its sun. Occasionally, the signal dimmed, as if being blocked by some occluding structure. Whoever was generating that transmission was moving with the planet, either on its surface or in a spacecraft following the same orbit. Time and again I crushed any hope that Purslane might have been responsible, while simultaneously wondering how a Gentian signature had ever made it to Andromeda. It could not be that someone had detected one of our ancient transmissions across intergalactic space, for the signal protocol was much too modern for that. I had still seen no evidence of the first machines, and only indirect evidence of the Andromeda priors. But as I approached the solar system, still traveling close to the speed of light, Dalliance began to make out awesome structures hanging in space near the star, as large as any prior artifacts documented in the trove. Prudence dictated a slow approach. I reduced my speed when I was still half a light year from the signal's origin, assessing the awesome, humbling spectacle awaiting me. I did not know whether this was the work of machines or organics. What I did know was that it made the grandest works of the line look like the rudimentary creations of cavemen scratching around a fire. We were proud of our star dams, but they were constructed from someone else's components. All we did was move the pieces around. We thought we were clever with our wormhole taps, whereas in fact we scarcely understood the first detail about how they functioned. The solar system I was approaching was a monument to godlike intellects, godlike abilities. It took the lofty ambitions of the lines and crushed them underfoot. It told us to come back when we were serious. It was a three-dimensional representation of the nested solids of the Platonic cosmos. Each of the 5 polyhedra, octahedron, icosahedron, dodecahedron, tetrahedron, cube, was inscribed and circumscribed by a sphere, represented by a latticework orb. The spars of this enormous construct were thicker than a sun, 100 times thicker than a world. They were many light minutes in length, so that the outermost sphere was wider than the largest stardam Gentian line had ever constructed. The polyhedra was rotating, each layer in the opposite direction to the one it encompassed. The system's solitary planet circled inside the vast construct, almost lost in that dark, ticking orrery. As I slowed down even further, I watched the planet pass through slots in the spars, its orbit undeflected. The structure was opaque enough to block the planet from view and mask the transmission from its surface, but it must have masked almost nothing. Hazily I wondered if it had been made from a stable form of the lesion matter left behind by the homunculus weapons. I dropped Dalliance to 20% of light, then 10%, then 5. I had been sending a corresponding Gentian identifier since my departure, alerting the signaler to my arrival, but there had been no response. The transmission had not changed its nature in 6,000 years. At 1/100th of the speed of light, Dalliance passed through the shell of the largest orb. I had been anticipating a response as I transgressed the outer layer, but there was no change in the structure, the planet, or the signal originating from it. By now I had established that the point of origin was on or near the surface, within the world's atmosphere. There was blue water and green life on the planet, and oxygen in the atmosphere. Subject to certain caveats, Dalliance had already assured me that I would be able to survive on the surface. I fell through the cube, through the tetrahedron, into the interstitial space of the dodecahedron. It was there that the planet's orbit was threaded, passing through the struts like wire through wood. The sun was 6 light minutes further in, nestling within the 2 smaller polyhedra and their surrounding shells. It was a lantern fretted by dark moving bars, throwing a shadow theater across the universe. I concentrated my attention on the planet, notching Dalliance down to an approach speed of only 1,000 kilometers per second. I had glimpsed continents and seas from interstellar space, but now I made out the detailed topography of the surface. As the planet completed a rotation, It had been adjusted to exactly 24 hours, implying a human connection. Dalliance refined its maps and scrutinized the data for signs of technological activity. That was when it found the orbiting wreck of Silver Wings of Morning, circling just above the point where atmospheric friction would have brought it down. My heart stalled in recognition. I had watched this lovely ship shrug off the attentions of interstellar civilizations, barely deigning to notice their weapons. I had struggled to chase her as she dived into the Stardam, oblivious to the ferocious course she had to follow. I had watched her rise and fall above the seas of a thousand worlds. I had come to associate her so strongly with the woman I loved that seeing her in this state was almost unbearable. Her last act must have been to bring Purslane to this world. The damage she had sustained was so extreme that I could not imagine her travelling at more than a small fraction of the speed of light. Whole kilometer-long sections of the ship had been ripped away, including much of the hull region where her engine was contained. The curved uplifted wings were buckled on one side and torn away on the other. The tarnished silver of her hull was now mostly black, except where previously hidden machinery showed through. Dalliance sniffed and tasted, finding only a dead wreck, devoid of power. I could send search probes through that 25-kilometer-long wreck, but I knew they would not find life. Perhaps Purslane was tucked deep inside, cocooned in abeyance, but my instincts said otherwise. For the sake of thoroughness, I knew I ought to search, but I did not know if I had the strength of mind to wait for the result. I tried hailing again. Hesperus, Hesperus or Purslane, it's Campion. Talk to me. There was no answer. I kept trying for 10 hours. At last I turned my attention to the surface and the origin of the Gentian signal. It was not that I had forgotten it, but Dalliance had already examined the focus of the transmission and found no signs of organized activity. Something was generating that signal, but I could only assume that Silverwings had dropped one of our beacons as her last functioning act, claiming this nameless world for the line. I still felt obliged to investigate. I pulled Dalliance into the atmosphere, touching breathable air for the first time since the Centaur's world. I dropped through billowing tropical clouds until I was overflying a quilt of dense green jungle, stretching from horizon to horizon and for thousands of kilometers beyond. I wondered about the origins of this solitary little planet. Perhaps it was the only world in the system that had not been taken apart and reforged into the ethereal matter of the platonic solids. Or perhaps it had been born orbiting another sun entirely, somewhere else in this empty galaxy. I wondered who had scaped it to its present state of biological fecundity, whether it had happened millions or billions of years ago. The origin of the Gentian signal could not be localized more accurately than to an area encompassing several square kilometers. It was as if it was being created by a transmitter that large, even though no such machinery was visible. I slowed Dalliance to less than a kilometer a second and quartered the area, searching for something that might not have been visible from space. The jungle had thinned out, the terrain changing to a series of flat, rocky plateaux intersected by plunging ravines. The sheer-sided plateau rose from dense, dark jungle, but their sides were rocky and devoid of vegetation. Some of them had microecologies on their upper surfaces, watered by pools fed by rainfall, draining via ribbon-thin, rainbow-banded cataracts. Others were arid and seemingly lifeless. Insofar as it could be pinned down, the Gentian transmission was originating from the surface of one of these barren plateaux. I brought Dalliance to a hovering posture 100 meters above the table-flat surface of the formation. My ship was much too large to land. She would overhang the plateau to a worrying degree. Forgoing a suit, trusting the ship's judgment that nothing in the atmosphere was likely to kill me quickly or irreversibly, I lowered a ramp and walked down, dressed only in the black clothes of Gentian funeral garb. Once I was clear, Dalliance pulled the ramp back in and rose until she was only a hand-sized shape in the sky. Wind snapped at me, warm and fragrant. The atmosphere was thick with pollen and microorganisms, goading my body's ancient defenses. I wiped my nose on my sleeve and walked towards the edge of the cliff until my toes were only a foot's length from the drop. The plateau terminated in a crumbling overhang. I thought of Cyphel's long fall. It was a long way down, and Dalliance would not be able to react quickly enough to save me if I lost my balance. As the breath-hot wind shifted direction, threatening to push me over rather than away from the edge, I took a hasty, undignified step backwards. "Sit with me a while, Campion." The voice startled me on two counts. I had not been expecting company, nor had I been expecting to hear a human voice, speaking trans, that I did not recognize. It was not Hesperus. It was also not Perslane. I turned around very slowly, for the speaker had come up behind me from what I had assumed was a completely deserted plateau. I was glad that I had not brought an energy pistol, for if there had been one in my hand I would surely have used it. It was a man, and it was not a man. A figure was walking towards me, strolling in a relaxed and unthreatening manner, raising one arm in welcome. It was assembling out of the air as it moved, gaining form and solidity. As it neared, I saw that it was composed of thousands of glass spheres, the same size as the marbles that had entertained me in the playroom when I had been Abigail. The marbles were flying in from all directions, sticking together to form the approximate shape of a walking man. They had been in the air until then, undetected except for the signal I guessed they had been transmitting, an aggregate of machines, much like the spirit of the air. "Who are you?" I asked. "Like I said, sit with me a while." The figure strolled to the very edge of the cliff and sat down with its legs dangling over the precipice. It was sitting to my left, a few meters from me. With a hand made of marbles, it patted the stony ground, making a chinking sound of glass on rock, encouraging me to join it. "Go ahead," it urged, still in a casual and welcoming manner, although there was something beneath that too human, too avuncular voice that absolutely forbade me from doing anything but obey it. "It's not as if you have anything else to do, is it, Shatterling?" The glass man was right. I had come here looking for Perslane, and for answers. Denied Perslane, I would settle for just the answers. Warily, I lowered myself to a sitting position, and dangled my legs over the edge, acutely aware of how little rock there might be below me. "I'll ask again. Who are you?" "You already know. You expected to find us in the galaxy, but when you arrived, we were gone. I am the only one left, the last of the first machines." Only Perslane called them that. But she spoke to Hesperus, and Hesperus remembered what she had said. The glass man corrected me. "Then you've spoken to Hesperus?" "Not exactly. He was very damaged when he arrived. It had been a difficult crossing. You've seen the ship." "And Hesperus?" "He fell to Earth. He'd had time to regather himself into a more compact form, but not much of his mind was left by the time I reached him. I took his memories, such as they were. There was little I could do for his personality. He had already discarded much of it of his own volition." The figure fell silent, as if a moment of respect was necessary after discussing the death of the other machine. I looked out across the chasm that separated us from the sheer wall of the next plateau, waiting for him to continue. Mist cloaked the forested ground, muffling the distant sound of a waterfall. "It was a pity," my companion continued eventually. "He and I would have had much to talk about, much to catch up on after so much time. I always enjoyed his company." "You couldn't have known, Hesperus. He was a machine person. You were dead and gone for millions of years before he came on the scene." "You're mistaken, Shatterling, but I can't blame you for not being in full possession of the facts. Hesperus was also a man, once upon a time. His name was Abraham Valmik. He was human, born in the Golden Hour. When the first machines emerged, Valmik was a great friend to us. We called him the Intercessor. We thought highly of him, and hoped that he might broker trust between our two orders of existence. We were mistaken, but it was not Valmik's fault. He did everything he could for us, and we have always been grateful for that." "Is it true that we killed the first machines?" "You sought to be able to kill us, to hold a dagger against our hearts. Unfortunately, the dagger slipped. It was an accident, but that does not lessen the repugnant fact of the dagger being put there in the first place. The glass man touched a hand to his chest. Some of us were fortunate. Far enough away from the hub of first machine society that we could run, or adapt ourselves to eliminate the threat. I was one of those that ran. We sought sanctuary in Andromeda, imagining that the organics would leave us alone if we let them have their galaxy in peace. We forgot the crime, I said. Then the machine people arose. Yes, promising, aren't they? Do you think much will come of them? He asked this confidingly, as if my answer was of genuine interest to him. We have hopes and fears. I think they'd like to destroy us all. And would you blame them if they did? You have, it must be said, demonstrated a distinct propensity for killing machine intelligences. The machine people would have every right to take defensive measures, wouldn't you say? I don't know. The Lines committed that atrocity and then covered it up afterwards. Should all the other cultures in the meta-civilization be held responsible for something they had no hand in, and don't even know happened? Now there's a question. We thought the first machines would come through the wormhole and assist the machine people. That's what Cadence and Cascade were counting on. Yes, Cadence and Cascade, he said with a measure of distaste. I know of them from Hesperus's memories. Well, what do you think, Shatterling? Do you see evidence of first machines gathering en masse to storm through the wormhole and exact a blood toll for the manner in which they were wronged? Do you see a slavering for revenge, that most pointlessly biological of imperatives? Apart from this system, I haven't seen much evidence of anything. Andromeda appears completely deserted. Not what you expected, then. We assume that the absence was the result of organized activity by Andromeda priors. When I learned about the first machines, I assumed they'd been responsible for it. But there's nothing here. Just millions of empty systems. You could be hiding, you could be disguising yourselves, but if you are, it's very well done. And now I don't even understand the absence. This is Andromeda. I know that from Dalliance's positional fix, but everything here looks absolutely normal. I can see all the way out to the edge of the universe. And yet, when I look in the direction of our galaxy, I see another absence there. You are right in one regard, the glass man said. The absence was the result of organized activity. Reactivating the wormhole link was one of the last acts of the first machines, before we left. I still don't get it. It's about the preservation of causality. What you perceived as the Andromeda absence was nothing but a barrier, permitting information to flow one way but not the other. It's still there. When you look into the sky, out to the edge of the universe, you are recording photons that have traveled through this barrier in the permitted direction. By the same token, no photons, no information-carrying entities of any kind, may leave Andromeda. You see a lightless envelope, encompassing the entire galaxy except for those outlying stars that happened to fall beyond it at the time it came into existence. The galaxy's gravitational field reaches through the barrier, but it is essentially static, conveying no information. And our galaxy? The same thing applies. From the moment the wormhole link was reactivated and superluminal information flow between the galaxies became possible, the galaxies had to be screened off from the rest of the universe. You are seeing the Milky Way absence from the outside now, but it has been in existence for as long as the one around Andromeda. But because information was free to reach you from outside, you had no idea of its existence. But we could never have left. No ship or signal would ever have been able to pass through that barrier. And have the Lines ever sent envoys into intergalactic space, Shatterling? No one ever reported back. Now you have your answer. The absence is a barrier that permits faster-than-light travel between two points in space, millions of light-years apart, without violating the causal ordering postulate. The wider universe never observes superluminal travel. Did you do this? Or just make it work again? Have some perspective, Campion. Machine intelligences have only been around for 5 million years. The priors who put the wormhole link in place had been manipulating matter and energy on a cosmological scale for billions of years. Even to them it must have been a daunting task. We still don't understand how they did it, only that it functions. But the price of intergalactic travel is that we can't go anywhere else. Is that what you're saying? I said nothing of the kind. Do you imagine that you arrived by the only wormhole link in and out of Andromeda? There are others, Campion. Many others. We've spent much of our time here recording their positions and guessing as to their destinations. He extended a hand to the sky, pointing in a particular direction, close to the west as measured by the slowly setting sun. If it were night, you would be looking in the direction of the Boötes Void, about 250 million light-years away, 100 times as far as you've already travelled, in other words. It's one of the largest empty spaces in the visible universe, a great region of space devoid of galaxies, the most perfect vacuum in creation. But what if there are galaxies in that darkness, but each hidden behind its own absence, each linked to the next by a superluminal wormhole? Imagine it, Campion, a vast, lung-like network of galaxies, thousands or tens of thousands of them, the equivalent of an entire supercluster. You'd see the absences. They'd block the light from the microwave background. Perhaps. The glassman waved his hand, as if he considered my point profoundly uninteresting. There are other theories, developed by the first machines, which say that absences may be tuned to a kind of invisibility, if the super-civilization deems it useful. We haven't reached that degree of understanding yet, but who knows what may become possible in a million or a billion years. The wormhole link is still settling down after a long period of dormancy. You'll have noticed the unpredictable nature of the space-time medium during your transit. The absence may also still be converging on its end-state condition. I started to speak, but he cut me off. The point is, there's a lot out there. I told you that I am the last first machine. That is only because I chose to remain behind when the others departed. They've left Andromeda via the outgoing wormhole links, intending to follow them as far as they are able. I don't doubt that they are already far beyond the local group, if they haven't already reached the Boötes Void. What do they hope to find when they get there? Something bigger and better than themselves. You've seen what we can do with matter, when the fancy takes us. Kepler's Platonic model, did you like it? It frightened me more than anything. That's how we feel about the Boötes Void super-civilization, if it exists. I watched the mist rising from the depths. Will you go? Now that I'm done here, why not? I've seen enough of Andromeda for one lifetime. And us? Are we going to be punished for what we did? The glassman put a marbled hand against my back, between my shoulder blades. Do you really imagine punishment is of the slightest interest to us? We nearly killed you all. You did, and it was unforgivable. Nonetheless, we offer our forgiveness. What is the point in being a superior civilization if you can't do that once in a while? I could push you off this cliff now, watch you fall all the way to the bottom. I might gain some barely measurable degree of satisfaction from seeing you die, knowing what you did to us. But would any higher purpose be served by that act? The pressure on my back eased. I was able to lean back a little. It's not what I expected. Surprises are always good. It's what we live for. Sentience like you and me. The glassman pushed himself to his feet. I think we're about done here, Shatterling. You can have this galaxy. I suggest you refrain from following us deeper into the wormhole network. Just for a few million years. Give it 5 million, 10, maybe. Then perhaps we'll be in a position to talk, meta-civilization to meta-civilization. In the meantime, try not to mess this one up. That thing you humans do. The turnover. There has to be a better way, don't you think? I don't know, I said in all truthfulness. We're still fumbling in the dark, trying to find out how to live on a galactic scale. You're right. It's still early days. I shouldn't be too harsh. Is there going to be a war? Between us and the machine people, I mean. If there is, it may already have started. Nothing has emerged from the wormhole since your arrival. But since you reached this world at only slightly less than the speed of light, that's not to say someone hasn't come through after you.
They may be on their way. They may be delayed by thousands of years. Or the Star Dam may have closed again. Whatever happens, I think it's safe to say that you are in for exceedingly interesting times. Macro war, taking in the entire Milky Way. It doesn't have to happen like that. Even if the war has begun, it may still be contained. You have enemies amongst the machine people, that's for certain. But you also have allies and sympathizers, like Hesperus. He wasn't the only one of his kind. The best thing would be for progressive elements in the human meta-civilization to reach out and embrace their counterparts in machine space. The lines could play a role, even a depleted, worn-out line that has blood on its hands. Gentian line. Exactly. We're finished. For all I know, I'm the last one left. I don't think so, Shatterling. Parts of him had begun to detach. Marbles were peeling away, taking flight, vanishing into the air. He touched a diminished hand to his forehead, absent-mindedly. I should have mentioned it already. You exited the wormhole a little over 3,000 years ago, by your reckoning. I nodded uneasily. Give or take. Silver Wings of Morning came out much earlier. She was damaged by the transit, incapable of fast flight. She reached orbit around this world 17,500 years ago. I felt as if the rock had finally given way beneath me. All hope gone. It had been there for a second, like the sun breaking through a crack in the clouds, bringing a glint of daylight. Now the clouds had closed over, heavier than before. I don't understand. I told you that the wormhole is still settling down. That's what happens. You'll just have to live with it until things stabilize. You'll cope. It's not as if you haven't already had some experience with deep time. You told me you found Hesperus. What happened to Perslane? Did you find her in stasis? I found the robot. He had fallen from space, abandoning the dying ship. Nothing could survive aboard her anymore. With the threat of an engine detonation, it would have been too hazardous even to remain in stasis. From what I could gather from his memory, it was not possible to land or take a shuttle. Hesperus must still have been locked out of vital control functions, even after the ship had brought him all the way here. Since she could not have been homing in on the Gentian signal, I could only presume that Silver Wings had steered towards the first hint of intelligent activity it found, the Platonic model solar system, with its strangely occluded star. Did he bring Perslane with him? I'll show you the robot, Shatterling. You may find it of interest. It won't take a moment. He's down in the jungle at the base of this plateau. The glass man beckoned out across the edge of the plateau. Step off. What? Unless you can think of another way to get down there. I wouldn't look to your ship. It would never fit. Don't worry. I'll be there to catch you. I only have your word for that. Yes, the glass man said. That's rather the point. There's going to have to be a lot more trust from this time forward. Why don't we start as we mean to go on? I closed my eyes. It occurred to me that perhaps this was the punishment, that the first machines had left behind the glass man to torment just one member of the human species, enacting their vengeance on me alone, rather than the rest of the meta-civilization. But, like Hesperus had said, revenge was for biologicals. Machines did things differently. I stepped off. There was a moment of weightlessness, time enough for me to begin to think that I had indeed been tricked. Then the pieces of the glass man caught up with my falling figure and supported me, just as the spirit of the air had supported me when we visited it on Naume. Marbles pressed under my arms, under the curve of my back, under my legs. I was lowered through mist, towards the roaring cataract, and into the green canopied gloom of the jungle. There was life there, but no animal life, nothing with a mind or a mouth. The forest was silent except for the swish of leaf on leaf, the creaking of old tree trunks, and the static hiss of falling water, like the radio simmer of a million quasars. Still being buoyed aloft, we came to a clearing near the base of the cliff. The mist was a white ceiling that occasionally thinned out to reveal bluer sky of the sheer edifice of the plateau. I landed softly. The clearing was floored with something like grass,
thick-bladed and damp with condensation. Grass was universal, even in Andromeda. The clearing was empty except for a glass sphere 3 meters across, with a golden form suspended inside. "He's still in stasis," the glass man said as he gathered his pieces back into human form. "He's been here 17,500 years, but he's experienced less than 6 days of subjective time." "Where's the apparatus? I don't see any stasis-generating machinery." "You wouldn't," the glass man said. He raised a hand and made the stasis bubble collapse, the barely recognizable form of Hesperus lowering slowly to the grass on his back. "There's a much simpler way of slowing time. You'll work it out, eventually, and then wonder what all the fuss was about." Hesperus's body was in a bad way. The gold armor was fused and blackened, as if he had been melted and then allowed to cool again. In places it was leathery, cracked like an old painting. In others it was as glassy as amber. He was larger than I remembered, less like a gold man than a gold sarcophagus in the shape of a man. His arms were fused with the sides of his body, his legs joined together into a single mass. His head, which was swollen, showed no indications of life. His features had been melted together, leaving only a half-formed approximation of a human face. His eyes were gone. The dark windows of his skull were scorched, but I could see no lights moving beyond them. "You already told me he was gone," I said. "You told me he was dead, that there was nothing left of his personality."
"That's still true."
"So why did you put him into stasis?"
"Because of what he contained. I told you that he sacrificed his higher functions, discarding much of his own personality. He did that for a reason. He had to make room inside himself, to protect the thing he cared for most."
The glass man nodded at my thoughts, as if they were transparent to him.
"He became armor, Campion. Altered himself, so that he could protect Perslane during the fall to Earth. Deciding to protect her would have been one of his last conscious acts as a fully formed sentience."
I had felt strong until then, but now I fell to my knees, next to the golden form.
"She's inside him.
There is a female human within the armor. The human is alive, albeit in a state of coma. I am no expert in these matters, but I believe the human to be unharmed. Of course, it may not be Perslane, but given the weight of evidence." I closed my eyes, sobbing with the force of the unseen cataract, all my worst fears draining out of me in a silvery rush. "I have to get the armor off," I said when I could speak again. I was racked by remorse for Hesperus, racked by desperate, intoxicating gratitude for the cargo he had kept safe.
"Then I'll help you," the glass man said, as my fingers dug their useless nails into the fused seams of that golden mask, "after which, with regret, I shall have to be on my way."
This concludes House of Suns. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers, or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalogue.